thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. And thank you to Laura and Renee and Jesse for helping to make this all happen. It's really wonderful to be here at ZKM. I think the last time I was here was in 2000, a long time ago. I'm Joseph DeLapp. I'm a professor of games and tactical media at Abertay University in Scotland. I've been in Scotland for 10 years now. I'm originally from San Francisco, California, where I grew up. And I sort of fell into media arts by attending San Jose State University in the early 1980s. That was really kind of when Silicon Valley was just sort of coming into being. So I kind of witnessed all of that, and for better or worse. I'm going to talk about a range of work today, and I was just going to say, if you have friends here, I promise I give good talks. Tell them to come. We have seats. This should be very interesting, I hope. I went into San Jose State University, and I was to study graphic design and illustration, and at a time when it was all being taught with analog materials, so pen and ink, rub on letters, hand lettering, all that stuff. San Jose State started a media arts, which was called Computer Art and Computer Arts and Design, in 1983, and I kind of took the first class they offered on kind of a whim, and I was really not interested in computers at all, quite the opposite actually, and found that it was a really amazing program and took me out of my interest in graphic design. And besides that, at the time I was being very politicized, going to hardcore punk shows in San Francisco, Dead Kennedys, Flipper, and this was the Reagan era and this kind of America's back and the sort of first tastes of kind of fascist nationalism being sown. But anyway, I took this class, and one of the first things, can we turn these lights down a little bit? I want these slides to be really, really clear. One of the first things we were exposed to was this book, Computer Power and Human Reason by Joseph Weizenbaum. If you know Joseph Weizenbaum, he's responsible for creating what was essentially one of the first chatbots. It was Eliza, a digital computerized therapist. But he did it as a way of questioning AI, right? Of saying, really coming from a humanist perspective, and that AI can never replace, you know, these things that should involve people. But of course, when he released this, people took the opposite. Oh, we can have all these digital therapists and help solve mental health care and all this stuff. And he was just aghast. So he wrote this book about it. Really interesting text. But the first interactive project I ever made was based on this project, his chatbot. Except I turned it into a computerized Catholic confessional. This was in 1983, it's a really crappy image because I don't have much documentation of this work. But you knelt down at an Apple II computer and went through the process of Catholic confession, similar to his use of the chatbot for a psychotherapist. This piece was no longer existed, but I actually recreated this in 2024, working with a program at in New York City for a show. And you can actually go and do this online through my website if you like, and get yourself some confession through the. And now these things are actually existing online, which is really kind of creepy, in real form. But anyway, it sort of set the tone, right, of how I engage technology and such things, and sort of politics, technology, all these things. Just some other very early work. This is not digital. This was my. I was very interested in photography at the time, wet processes in the darkroom, and this was again the emergence of Ronald Reagan and the sort of America is back and American exceptionalism, and I saw sort of parallels at this time between what happened in your country and what is now happening in my country. So these are double exposed negatives, kind of randomly shot from history books of World War II, Nazi Germany, and kind of images of America from historical contexts and news magazines and that sort of thing. The series was called Gott mit uns, but it really was my first kind of hardcore political work. Jumping ahead sometime here, I do sculpture, I do all kinds of things. This is actually a physical sculpture of two apple mice put together, and this comes from working and running computer labs at the university where I was working at the time in Reno, Nevada. And this was at a time when these devices would wear out, and we had a computer lab with probably about 60 students working in it. I think we had 6 computers, so these were getting a lot of wear and tear, so the mice would die. And I started collecting them, and then I started making sculptures out of them. This led to a whole series of works of investigating and kind of trying to recreate discarded technologies, right? We go through this stuff so fast, and part of this is also coming from Silicon Valley. I started haunting this kind of Silicon Valley surplus store that had just enormous. I mean, like the size of this building practically, full of bins of discarded technology from the computer industry. And I would go buy boxes of mice, joysticks, etc., and make these sculptures. This is probably the most ambitious work of this series. It's a mouse mandala. All of these are mice that came out of Silicon Valley cubicle culture. So they're dirty, they're broken, so these are woven together into this massive weaving as a kind of faux mandala, kind of with religious intonations, but also playing on the Luddites, the history of the Luddites from England in the 19th century, who were weavers and such, who were revolting against being thrown out of work by the Industrial Revolution and automation. Same time frame of working with the mice, this was my artist's mouse, which I essentially created an appendage for my actual desktop mouse, attaching a pencil. And when I made this, it was like, yeah, I was inspired by a number of things. One was kind of industrial photography, like this, which is the Gilberths, who did this process of putting lights on workers so you could trace their movements and they could help make workers more efficient in the factory so you could build things as quickly as possible. But I love the images, they're beautiful, and I thought kind of similar, like it would sort of map my time. When I made this, I had just been playing video games for a couple years. I was playing this game at the time, the original Unreal. So I replaced my mouse pad with pieces of drawing paper, and I played levels of the game. So each of these drawings is a complete level of that game. 10 drawings in total, I think, 10 levels, if I remember correctly. But they're really, it made these marks in this kind of, like you could trace back my experience of the game through this drawing. This led to a number of, this is kind of my entry into video games as a sort of subject and process for my work. Along the way, you know, Quake was released, and also games started to be playable online. In that context, I was really fascinated by, you know, here are these virtuals, they're kind of creating these sort of virtual 3D environments that you can run around in, but we're just killing each other. Seemed kind of bizarre on some level, especially considering all of the sort of hype around the first wave VR and all that we're going to do all these things, we'll all be unified, and technology is going to make us all happy. But I was playing these games online, and I just had this idea of what if, instead of going and playing by the rules, I went into this space and did something else. And it was a way of sort of thinking about the rhetoric surrounding the internet, that it's this new public commons, that these kind of game spaces, these environments that you play in, these maps, are really kind of like these theater spaces. So why not perform? Why not do something else? So I looked at this as kind of like doing street theater in a game space. And this is an image from what I reenacted yesterday, which is my first in-game performance, which was Howl Elite Force Voyager Online, where I read in its entirety and typed at the same time where I'm reading, so it's very stilted. Allen Ginsberg books his book-length, very famous beat poem into the game. This took many hours at the time. It was much faster yesterday, which was kind of bizarre. But this was a really kind of pivotal moment in my work. Honestly, when I did this, I thought, this is really stupid. But I was also like, this is really kind of funny. And this is, there's something here. And I, you'll see as the work progresses, I kept coming back and kind of evolving this concept. But I was also doing, at the same time, many more drawings. Each of those drawings is a month of all of my computer time. That one was done when I was chair of my department at the university and sitting at my desk doing administrative boring work. So I was, you know, incorporating work, play, all these things. 2003 was another really sort of pivotal performance work. I invited six of my students who were gamers, and we formed a temporary performance group. And we all went into the same Quake server, Quake 3 arena server, each of us as a character from the TV show Friends, and we reenacted an entire episode via the text chat. And this was totally bonkers. We eventually did a second version of this. We did the first one in the computer lab at the university. This second one was done in the gallery at the university, and we had each point of view projected. So one of those is Chandler, one is Ross, one is, you know, Rachel, etc. And each of us is typing and talking, and the game's going on, headshot, you know, just complete chaos. One of the curious things about this was it got written up in the New York Times about a week before the performance. And about 2 days before the performance, I got a letter from Warner Brothers Television, a cease and desist, like basically saying, you cannot use our copyright material. And I actually pushed back against that. It was like, this is fair use, give me a break. This is totally satirical and I'm not making any money and all that stuff. So, but all of this was going on while the world was changing, as it ever does. But the same time frame, you know, the 9/11 attacks had happened in 2001. I watched the Bush administration lie us into a war in Iraq, etc. But all the while, there were this process of developing a memorial for the 9/11 attacks was very public and very much an open call. And I remember seeing this. This is a website you can still go to and see all 5,201 entries for a memorial. Which is appropriate, right, to remember this horrible event. But when I saw this, I was like, we're never going to do this process for all the civilians who are now dying in Iraq. And also started thinking about what's going to be the memorial to the soldiers, to the American soldiers who are dying in Iraq. And both of those things, those ideas contributed to projects. I'm going to share some of them here. But this was really kind of my deep dive into engaging my work as a media artist, as a political media artist. So America's Army was a game released in 2002 by the Defense Department in the United States as a recruiting and marketing tool for the US Army. And I remember when this came out, and I had done Howl and other things, and I was thinking, oh, this is a serious game. Something needs to happen in this space. And it took some time before I developed an idea, an approach. And what I landed up doing was going into the game, but my avatar's name was Dead in Iraq, and rather than playing the game, I would drop my weapon and type in the names of actual US soldiers who had died in the war. And this was not a popular thing to do. I received death threats and all kinds of fun things from this, but it was really intense, and I went into this quietly and just started doing it, and I was really nervous about it. It eventually got picked up by several news programs, CNN, NPR in the States, it was on Canada Broadcasting, etc. And I found myself constantly on the defense from people basically like, this is a game, what are you doing this here? And my rejoinder was essentially, no, this is not a game, this is actually sanctioned government property. This is like connected to what was happening in Iraq. It's a military, it's part of the whole military industrial complex. But the comments are rather typical of what people would say, you know, please, this is not the forum to do this. I don't give a fuck. Man, will all the hackers go play ping pong or something? it was fascinating as well, being constantly like having stories in Wired magazine, Salon, all these publications, and then reading through the comments, which were mostly negative. And I decided not to just ignore them, but I actually registered for those publications in my full name, and I started responding to people as a way of carrying the work forward and explaining myself and saying, no, look, I'm paying taxes. This is partly me. And this is a way of both memorializing these young people who have been killed and also a cautionary gesture, a way of saying to people who are playing this game, because this was a recruiting tool, right? The military would track players. This is a way of putting something in where when you're playing these games, you're not really thinking, right? It's like you stop playing it and it's like watching a sitcom on TV. You sort of forget about it. I guarantee the people who played this with me remembered what I was doing, right? What was that? And then, you know, the thought process goes on. At least, you know, that's my hope. I did perform this live in front of audiences a couple times, but mostly it happened online. It's just a little video showing some of what would happen in that space. So you'll see me, you basically join your platoon of fellow soldiers. And then I will drop my weapon. And I usually go find just kind of a vantage point. And I stand in place. And then you'll see up on the top left, I start typing the names. And I did these in consecutive order as they had happened and as they were released during the war.
Ricardo X Rodriguez, 23RU, October 4th, 2000.
I would usually get killed very quickly. This is a game where you get to die once. You'd have to wait till the next round to come back and play. So I would hover over my fallen avatar and keep typing. Like I said, it wasn't a popular thing to do. The America's Army system was, they had comic books, graphic novels, a website, and they also had action figures. And when I saw the action figures, I have these model building skills from when I was a teenager and a nerd, and I thought, I want to make a different kind of action figure. So I actually kit-bashed between action figures to recreate that image of my fallen avatar, which was this. And curious thing happened, you know, I did a Google search to find an image of, you know, the action figures. And when I put in U.S. Army action figure, it came up with this image result. And it kind of blew me away, because that's my work. That's my work. That's my work. That's my work. Right? It was like this accidental intervention into Google image space. And it you'll see something else that came about after that. But going back to kind of responding to critics of this work, there was one point where I was having a dialogue back and forth with a detractor, and he said, "Dude, you got a Gandhi complex." And I was like, so you think being like Gandhi is somehow like having a mental illness? But I was like, okay, if you say I'm Gandhi, works for me. I was researching a lot about the nature of protest and the history, and kind of so many things that we do today in terms of protest, Gandhi was one of the first, including these sort of mass marches. And the Salt March was something that really stuck out to me. And it was 1930, he walked 240 miles, had thousands of followers by the end of his march. He went to a beach in Dandi and collected salt, which was illegal because the British Empire owned it. So I thought, you say I'm Gandhi, I'll be Gandhi. So I went into Second Life, the online community, and I made a Gandhi avatar. And I proposed this project to IB Martin Technology in New York City. And essentially, it involved hacking a Nordic Track WalkFit treadmill, which is not electric. You actually have to push into a game controller. And I walked with my Gandhi avatar. over 26 days, taking the same rest days as Gandhi took, and reenacted the distance of the Salt March, and going through this virtual world and essentially interacting with the other residents. It was an incredible experience. I'm going to jump through this just in the interest of time, but and I'm doing this at the same time I was doing Dead in Iraq, right? This very dark project about death and going into Second Life as Gandhi, and basically I would walk and search out other residents and I would gift them my walking stick and I'd say, come join with me. And universally, people were happy to see me. You know, it was like this salve in a way to what was going on with Dead in Iraq. But what was incredible about this was 23 days on a treadmill, walking about 10, 12 miles a day, really changed me. I lost 8 pounds, and I found myself in really seriously having that weird phenomenon where you're in this space so much that your reality shifts. Like I'd walk down the street in New York City going back to my apartment and think I could click on people and get information, right? And it was really like, whoa, like, wait a minute. And all I did, I ate, you know, I would eat dinner, I'd sleep, wake up the next morning, eat breakfast, go walk, eat dinner, fall asleep. You know, it was like, I lived this work for a month. It was an incredible experience. Post-walk, I had the opportunity for a big exhibition at IBM, and they were in Chelsea at the time, at a huge warehouse space. And I wanted to do something with my Gandhi avatar, so I used some open source software to pull the avatar out of the environment. And I started working with Pepecura Designer, papercraft program, to kind of recreate my avatar in sculptural form. And I adapted this desktop, you know, kind of printing process into a monumental scale, and eventually built a 17-foot tall version of my avatar out of cardboard. This was 6 weeks of hard labor and engineering to figure out how to get this thing to stand up. But it really sort of represented the monumentality of the experience. Like it was very, it was a transformative thing. Next kind of thing, I'm jumping around a little bit, but this project really sort of dovetails a little bit out of that. I was doing this performance work, and this was like my first real bodily performance as well, walking on the treadmill, but I was inside the whole time. And I was like, I want to do something out in the world. And I read this quote, if a concentrated solar power system was built 100 mile by 100 mile square in size in the American Southwest, this would be more than enough to meet the country's entire energy demand. And that just sounded completely reasonable to me. Like I said, I lived in Nevada, up in Reno, there on the top left, and I looked at the map, and I was like, what's that area right there? And that is the largest peacetime military base in the world. And I looked into it a little bit. It's Nellis Air Force Range. Now it's called the Nellis Test and Training Range. This is where Area 51 is. This is where they did all the America's nuclear tests. It's still an active base at the time. Curiously, that's about exactly 100 miles square in area. So I came up with this idea, what if I was to encircle that and identify this as like, we could be doing something else with this land. So what I did, I'm an avid cyclist. I converted a long tail bicycle into a drawing machine. It's kind of the reverse of my mouse in a way, but I cast these chalk, pieces of chalk out of gypsum, which is plaster. Much of Nevada is made from gypsum. And I rode over 10 days, can't remember the distance now, 300 and something miles as I recall, around the base, drawing a line, kind of symbolically encircling that space, a way of kind of a sort of alternate proposal for what you might do with this territory, which was actually technically still belonged to Native American tribes, but was taken from them. In doing this project and researching what took place at this base, one of the main things was the Creech Air Force Base, which is one of the main command, control, and training centers for America's emerging drone warfare at the time. And I became obsessed with drones. after this project. And I did a load of work about drones. I'm going to show you a few pieces here, but this is my first kind of drone work. And I took the top image search from Google for Predator drone and downloaded it and kind of rebranded the fuselage and made a whole series, about 20 of these, as I recall. And just as cowardly drones, like just, you know, sitting in a trailer in Las Vegas and bombing something on the other side of the world from these remote aircraft, to me, just is, there's something completely absurd about it. And it was also happening, you know, during the Obama administration. Obama was the one who ramped up use of drones, double taps, all that fun stuff. So I put these back on the internet and put them on my website, on Tumblr, various sites, to see if I could do what that action figure did previously. And at the time, about a month and a half after putting 20 of these images on various places on online, including Facebook, etc., if you went on Google and did a Predator drone search, this was in like the top 20 results. There's my work, and there's my work. And it was like, yes, like it got in there. And just a way to sort of interrupt that image stream, right? And get, I really hope people came across and were like, you know, like their head exploded. But I did a number of other pieces with drones, including this is a kind of wearable drone. It's a personal drone system. It's a performative sculpture. So it's strapped to my head and I would walk around and be like, and somebody say, hey, there's a drone. I turn around, I can't see it. You know, it's like, but I did this, I was on residency at Autodesk in San Francisco, and Autodesk actually owns Instructables. Is Instructables a thing here? You're all a bunch of hackers. You guys know Instructables? Yes? No? It's a very popular website where you can learn to do anything, and you share what you make. I'm probably one of the first kind of contemporary artists to share work on this space. So I shared personal drone system, me and my Predator, and I went through the steps of making this. And this was part of the requirements of being a resident there. But what was really interesting was this was like intervening, putting politically oriented making into this very apolitical space of making and hacking and building. And the comments are just crazy, like really, you know, what the fuck, how is this a drone? Da 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 da, you know, it started people, you know, again, that sort of process going. I did another piece that was shared on there. This is called In Drones We Trust. And these are rubber stamps that I sent out freely to people across the United States and around the world, inviting them to stamp their cash and sort of bringing drones home, right? Like here's a drone over the White House, which was kind of the first concept. There's a Tumblr site that's still up, and I got hundreds and hundreds of photographs from people who I sent drones to, and they stamped the cash, and then they would go spend it. This is another one I did a Instructable for, and the comments on here was actually became a really intense political debate, which, again, for me is a win as a political artist to sort of bring not only kind of contemporary art content into this kind of neutral makerspace kind of environment, but it just was like, wow, I didn't expect these kind of results and to sort of impact the conversation in a way. Back to talking about games a bit. So this is just, you know, illustrates, this is, you know, the Medal of Honor version that was in Afghanistan that was, this was the only game ever banned on American military bases. But it just shows, you know, the typical game kind of mechanisms of equal sides, equal weapons, you know, these kind of shooter games, two-person, whatever, multiplayer. But I got asked to apply for a bit of funding in the States for a project. And I thought, you know, I've done so much work in video games, virtual worlds, maybe it's time I make a game. So my idea was I wanted to make a game about drone warfare. Problem with drone warfare, you know, in terms of gameplay, you know, one side has all the agency, the other side, you're simply bombed, right? So how to make that into something interesting, complex, difficult, So this is what first brought me to Dundee. Dundee is kind of the capital of games in the UK. And I had a friend, a curator, live there and told her I got this funding. She said, oh, you should come to Dundee. So I came and I worked with some game developers there who eventually became the Biome Collective. And we worked on this project called Killbox. And Killbox is essentially a two-person playable video game. It's freely downloadable on Steam, et cetera. And what we came up with was essentially two points of view. You're either the drone pilot, or you're this kind of childlike, spherical being on the ground on this farm in North Waziristan. We actually modeled the map on an actual location of a drone strike where a Waziri grandmother was blown up in front of her children. So it has this kind of attachment to reality, but we wanted to create something that really sort of drew you in very quickly. Ideally, you would be sitting across the table from the person you're playing with. But you can do this online and play it as a single player as well. But one of the main kind of mechanisms that we put into this that I think really worked very well, this is kind of the more formal installation environment. It looks a bit like one of those drone trailers. If you're playing as the drone pilot over here, you go through the process of launching your drone strike and you kill the person across from you. And they realize, you sort of look up and it's a bit jarring. Game ends and then it restarts, but the roles switch. So the drone pilot becomes the child and the child becomes a drone pilot. And so it has this way of kind of giving a kind of simulated experience of what it might be like on either end of these processes. Some other projects, this is a more recent cardboard sculpture, Liberty Weeps. Made this original one in 2015 with a group of volunteers in Los Angeles for a really amazing show with Shepard Fairey and a bunch of other people. More recently, I've done a 3D print of this work. And some other game projects. This is a very complex project. So I've moved to Scotland. I got offered this job at Averté on the success of Killbox, largely. We got nominated for a Scottish BAFTA, which is a bit like an Oscar nomination, and it was a very big deal. But I got hired, and soon after, I was really fortunate to be awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in the United States, which was cash to me as an artist. And I had just applied before I moved to Scotland, so it was brilliant. It helped me get situated. But with that funding, I did this project and several others. I didn't know until I got to Dundee. Dundee is actually where Rockstar Games is from. It's where GTA started. And I had been, you know, I'd played it and that kind of thing, but I had this idea, and a bit complicated, but I got to the university about a year later. There was that horrible school shooting in Florida, just forgetting the name of the school. Donald Trump came out, he was president at the time, his first round, and he blamed video games, right? And there was a Scottish newspaper called the university and said, any of your games experts want to opine on what Donald Trump has said about video games? And they said, oh, talk to this Yank, we got this new faculty, blah, blah, blah. So, and I researched it a little bit, and the crazy thing is like, when I did Dead in Iraq, just under 5,000 American soldiers died in Iraq over 10 years, right? In a year in the U.S., between 15 and 19,000 Americans are killed by guns and homicides. It's almost double that if you consider suicides. So, I don't know, I just had this, and also just loads of research, basically nothing connects game violence directly to real world violence. Like there's no, you know, kind of cause and effect. So I did this project where I was like, it's almost like the game pointing back at us. So what I did, I worked with the programmer who did Killbox, and we hacked GTA and turned it into a American gun violence visualization system, right? So when you see the date, that's the date when the project was running. This was a 24/7 self-playing version of the game. At midnight each night, the game would scrape the data from the Gun Violence Archive in the United States, which noted how many homicides there had been since January 1st. It would input that into the game, and then over the next 24 hours, our automated version of GTA would play through all of those deaths. And then midnight the next night, it would scrape the data again, add the additional numbers of who had been killed that day, and so on. So it built over the year. This was on Twitch 24/7, has a soundtrack of God Bless America. It was my least favorite patriotic song. You can see it a bit in action here. We had a reverse tracking camera point of view from an invisible avatar. And you'll see, let me get rid of that, sorry. So you see as the avatars kill each other, the number will start going up and so on. The song just repeats over and over. It just so happened this was the anniversary of the first release of the song from 1938. And it was set up to randomly begin each midnight at, we selected about 15 different locations in GTA, so it would always be moving about. And it was a real crazy experience babysitting this project for a year. I was living on my phone, on my laptop, like I'd be watching my PC in the studio and having to reboot when it crashed and all that. Jump forward. Post-pandemic, the pandemic sort of killed my work, really was very difficult. My family in the States really worried about my mother and my twin children in New York City. I flew back into New York early September 2021, first time I was going to get to see my family in 2 years. And when I landed, I realized, whoa, it's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And 9/11 had been so pivotal in terms of the development of my work, the war on terror, all of that. So I just a week or so before was the disastrous withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. If you remember, there was a drone strike that happened where the Ahmadi family was blown up, the father was actually an aid worker bringing supplies home to his family, and all of his kids came out to greet him, and they were all blown up, 10 people killed. And it was documented, and it was, I think we knew about it because the press was there. This is not atypical in terms of drone strikes and what has happened. So I had this idea. If you had a family member who was killed on 9/11 and you go to the memorial, they will give you a piece of paper and a black crayon and invite you to go do a rubbing of your family member's name. So I kind of did this myself with my own paper and my own crayons, but instead of the names that were there, I recreated the first names of each member of this family who had been blown up. And it's called Remembering the Ahmadis. It was a sort of personal memorial, a way of, again, like a lot of the work I think I've been doing with memorialization, commemoration, is to question who's remembered, who's mourned, who is meaningful, who exists. So it was a way of, this was very emotional, very difficult experience in that space, which is like this hyper-patriotic, like, focus of kind of this American exceptionalism and the whole history of the space is so problematic to me. So I did these and it was something else. Brought them home with me and, you know, I had them framed for exhibitions and have shown these around a bit. But yeah, this was, for me, this was like closing a loop again in the same way the America's Army game had done. see how we're doing here. Okay, I think we're doing very well for time. This next project, so AI, right? It's in the background of our lives now, and I had this idea, and I'm really kind of, I don't know, I'm a bit despondent over to see where things have gone with all of this. But I had this idea that I wanted to do my original idea was to do a deep fake video of Donald Trump reading Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism. What I landed up doing was a cheap fake. I call it a cheap fake. I used really purposefully garish tools to do this and made a video. And I'll just show you a bit of this.
A reading from Hannah Arendt's book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, Chapter 11, The Totalitarian Movement, Section 1, Totalitarian Propaganda. Only the mob and the elite can be attracted by the momentum of totalitarianism itself. The masses have to be won by propaganda under conditions of constitutional government and freedom of opinion. Totalitarian movements struggling for power can use terror to a limited extent only and share with other parties the necessity of winning adherents and of appearing plausible to a public which is not yet rigorously formal all other sources of information. It was recognized early and has frequently been asserted that in totalitarian countries.
So, yeah, it's crap. I mean, but it kind of works, and it was, I'm fairly happy with it, but it's also, it's a piece that, I don't know, I'm kind of purposefully not engaging AI in my practice physically. I'm working on some projects that will address AI going forward, but, yeah, it is what it is. You can see it on YouTube or through my website. But yeah, one of the things, moving abroad, moving to Scotland as an American and seeing what has happened in the United States and seeing that my countrymen have decided to vote this fucking idiot back into office a second round. I'm in Scotland, I'm watching what's happening, and I feel completely helpless, especially as this kind of activist media artist. So I had this idea last year, July 4th. I set up a desk in Edinburgh, and I handmade. This is an American flag I bought in New York City. It's cotton, American made, and I cut these letters out of Scottish wool, sewed them. First time I used a sewing machine, it was quite fun. But I made this, and I went and sat in the center of Edinburgh on the 4th of July and simply sat there, and I just apologized to people as they came by. And this was like really, it was very meaningful. It was very, I found myself mostly listening and finding myself just sitting there and listening to people. I had a little greeting card, a sorry card that I would sign and give a number and give to each one. A few weeks later, I took this up to Aberdeen because Donald Trump was visiting his golf course. And this was very intense as well. This is actually the first person who came to see me. I was sitting by the Wallace statue in Aberdeen. She was a Romanian refugee, Ukrainian refugee who had lived in about six countries trying to find some place where she would feel at home, and she landed up in Scotland. She talked to me for half an hour, and by the end she was in tears and we were hugging each other, and it was really something. But This was filmed for Reuters and went around the world, and again found like going to all these places where people were commenting, especially MSN in the United States. It was just crazy. Like the MAGAs just went nuts, which is great. So some other work about Trump. Have any of you seen this? So this is Janie Godley. Janie Godley is a Scottish comedian. She passed away about a year and a half, 2 years ago from cancer. Hilarious. Working class Scottish, she's one of my heroes. On the day Brexit passed, Trump was visiting his golf course south of Glasgow at Turnberry. So she just very spontaneously made this sign and went and stood across the street from where he was staying. And it just became this iconic expression. She's really an inspiration to me. I've started this project, a new project, again sort of incorporating some of my model building skills. And I have created a proposed monument to Janie Godley, Trump is a cunt. And I'm actually doing a whole series of these. The basis of these is actually an action figure. That's a figure from the Doctor Who series, a 6-inch action figure that I've reconfigured. And I've got a number of, what I want to do is basically sort of icons of protest, but also kind of just people protesting, going and the idea is this is, I'm going to do something with this that will become sort of a proposal to the Scottish government or something, but really sort of get this out there in a way. Right now it's in the 200th annual exhibition at the Royal Scottish Academy in Edinburgh, which is really awesome. And I actually, through that process, got in touch with Janie Godley's daughter, who is named Ashley, and she's got a hit TV show in the UK right now called Dinosaur. If you haven't seen that, check it out. But anyway, hopefully going to meet her at some point. Last project I'm going to show you, it takes some explaining, and I'm losing my voice here, so I'm going to drink some water. And about a year and a half ago, a colleague of mine from Mississippi State University reached out to me, and Jenna Altamonte, and she had been in touch with an American writer, Antonio Aiello, who had written two books with Mansour Adaifi, who was a 14-year prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And like 90% of the detainees, he was innocent, and they were essentially sold to the Americans in Afghanistan and such. So they approached me and they said, hey, we're interested in making a video game about Mansour's story. Do you know anyone who might be capable of taking this on? So immediately I thought of the Biome Collective, and we had done this Kill Box, and I approached them about it. And they, like myself, initially was like, whoa, like how would you turn this into a game? So we met with them online, had some game jams online, and we got some funding from Creative Scotland to hold a workshop, which was 2 weeks ago. Was delayed, supposed to be in February, delayed because it has been impossible to get a visa for Mansour to come to Dundee through the Home Office in the UK. So sadly, he was remote in Serbia, where he is kind of under loose house arrest, but he can't go back to Yemen, which is his home. We have been working with him, and we've read his book, we've been talking with him, but we worked with him to do a kind of game jam and come up with some concepts for a game. This is just, I'm going to show you a video of a very loose concept for one of the kind of mini games that might fit into the larger game. But his book and how he talks about, he became, basically when he was arrested, he was 18 years old, Yemeni in Afghanistan. He was there for a benefactor who was going to help him get to university. He basically got... He got sold to the Americans by a warlord who said, oh, he's this 38-year-old Egyptian general in Al-Qaeda. And the CIA took him in, and they basically interrogated him, like, you know, who are you? Oh, we know who you are, and all this kind of thing. And he's like, what? I'm Mansour. I'm 18 years old. What are you talking about? And he got so angry by the way he was treated that he became a leader of the resistance at Guantanamo Bay. But anyway, I'm going to show you this very quickly because I am running out of time, and I do want some time for questions. But this game is based on, he told us about a communication system they worked out with his brothers, his fellow prisoners, and they would sing to each other messages, and the American soldiers thought they were doing a call to prayer, but they were actually communicating. And so this is based on that, and it's very, this is really quite preliminary in terms of the design. So if you imagine, you would click on other prisoners as you would go, and it would build to this crescendo of voices. And the idea is, like, they didn't know what time it was. They didn't know where Mecca was. Many of them didn't know where they were. So it was a way of kind of creating a kind of sense of community. I'm going to jump ahead here so you can see where it goes. And the idea is that eventually it would become this sort of almost like swirling, kind of mass of these prisoners escaping momentarily through the unity of song. And then you go back. But anyway, this is really a broad concept. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have quite some time for questions, about 10 minutes. If you have a question,
any questions?
Please raise your hand, and we bring the microphone to you so that you will be heard. Any questions? Yeah.
Sorry. When you were working with the video games, right, like, and looking at this politics of the games and the contrast between, like, the killings in the real life and in GTA, what was it that attracted you to GTA specifically, besides the obvious parody of America culture?
It was partially that I had moved to Dundee, where it came from. And the funny thing about the development of GTA is, in my understanding, is none of those Scottish game developers had ever visited the United States. It was all based on kind of gangster films and that kind of stuff. And so it is this kind of idealized America, and it just made sense. And it also is, you know, it's a very controversial game. It's very violent, very sexist, very racist in a way. And it just seemed the appropriate territory. And it was also, yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of factors, but it just seemed to make sense. Like, that was, you know, such a popular title, and it really, it also had the space, it had the avatars, it had the, you know, the capacity to kind of do what I wanted to see happen in there. The development of that game, of the intervention, was really complicated, though. Working with my programmer, who now works for Rockstar Games, by the way, we were limited by what we could change. It was quite fascinating, because my first concept for that was, I just wanted to see a growing mass of bodies, like, in one place. Like, imagine, you know, 5,000 dead bodies piling up in that virtual space. But what we discovered is, in GTA, you're limited to 256 avatars per region. So it was like, okay, then we're going to have to move. And so we moved, we did a forward camera motion, and it just didn't look right. And then I said, back, let's do a reverse motion. And that was kind of like perfect. Like, it was this end of the movie, like, you know, this sort of constant kind of walking away. And I think it actually became, in some ways, like, my way of walking away from the U.S. as well, kind of this kind of parting gift in a way. But yeah, I hope. Thanks for the question. Other questions?
Yes, another question.
Thank you. while doing art, did you face any legal repercussions or harassment from the police, or either British or American?
Not so much. When I was actually going out and doing the Sorry project, well, I mean, you know, when I was in New York City doing the remembering the Ahmadis, I was really nervous. Like, whenever I do these things, you just get like completely freaked out. And I was very nervous doing that. But my daughter Sarah came along and was photographing, and she was kind of, you know, it's good when you do these things to have a backup, like someone there with you. But I did it kind of surreptitiously, but in the open. And I found with these things, like when I did the bike ride around the Air Force base, I was really nervous about that as well, because it's like if you get too close to that base and if you do weird things there, they do surveil. That's entirely surveilled. And there were several times where I saw, you know, helicopters fly over, or you see these white Broncos kind of driving. And I purposefully, I don't know if you saw my jersey. I custom made these jerseys to look like I was really official. So I had an American flag on this side. I had a state of Nevada flag on this side. So I was like, you know, I looked like I was some kind of official thing. And I think I have found, and I think other activists who do this sort of thing, if you dress the part, like if you look like you belong, you can tend to get away with things. Like there's been a lot of things happening like in England this last, like you probably saw that Banksy sculpture that he put up with the flag. There was one put up this last week of a Palestinian political prisoner right across from the parliament. But they all come dressed, all the workers come dressed in matching jumpsuits. Like they all look like they're, you know, so if you, I think it's partly just like you act like you belong. And when I did the Sorry piece, I had researched it a bit because, you know, the UK is different in terms of free speech than the States, but I did research it, and it was okay what I was doing. Like if you did a march, you have to register that. But if you do a single action somewhere, it's okay. So be kind of doing a bit of background research, being sure. I didn't want to get in trouble doing that piece, but I do remember in Edinburgh specifically, some police walked by and they were just very nice. You know, they were like, oh. And generally, people in Scotland are very nice. I did it in London as well. I didn't have any issues. But really good question. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, there are other questions, but we are running out of time, regrettably. Okay. So if you have questions, are you available?
Yeah, I'll be here. I'll be outside, so you can come chat with me if you like.
Yeah. So I think there are probably a lot of ideas going through all our minds.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Professor Dillard.